Chapter 44. "You fool!" Thomas Machita shouted across the desk. "You bloody fool!" Colonel Randolph Jumana sat and regarded Machita's outburst with controlled indulgence. "I had the very best of reasons for issuing those orders. Who gave you the authority to attack that village and slaughter fellow blacks?" "You overlook basic facts, Major." Jumana removed a pair of horn-rimmed reading glasses and stroked one side of his flattened nose. "During General Usana's absence, I am in command of the AAR. I am simply carrying out his directives." "By switching attacks from military targets to civilian villages," Machita snapped angrily. "By terrorizing our brothers and sisters whose only crime is working as underpaid civil servants for the South Africans?" "The strategy, Major, is to drive a wedge between the whites and the blacks. Any of our people who hire out to the government must be labeled as traitors." "Black members of the defense forces, yes," Machita argued. "But you can't gain support by indiscriminately murdering school teachers, mailmen, and road laborers." Jumana's face went cold and impersonal. "If killing 100 children would advance our ultimate victory over the whites by 1 hour, I would not hesitate to give the order for execution." Machita was swept by a wave of abhorrence. "You're talking butchery." "There is an old Western world saying," Jumana said flatly, "the end justifies the means." Machita stared at the obese colonel and his flesh crawled. "When General Usana hears of this, he will expel you from the AAR. Jumana smiled. "Too late. My campaign to spread fear and havoc throughout South Africa is irreversible." Jumana managed to look even more sinister. "General Usana is an outsider. He will never be fully accepted by the tribes of the interior, nor by the black leaders of the cities as one of their own. I guarantee he will never sit in the Prime Minister's office in Cape Town." "You're talking treason." "On the other hand," Jumana continued, "you were born in Liberia before your parents immigrated to the United States. Your skin is as black as mine. Your blood has not been fouled by mixed sexual intercourse with whites, as have most American blacks. It might not be a bad idea, Machita, for you to consider a change of allegiance." Machita replied coldly, "You swore the same oath as I when we enlisted in the AAR, to uphold the principles set down by Hiram Lusana. What you're proposing sickens me. I want no part of it. Rest assured, Colonel, your treachery will be exposed to General Lusana within the hour." Without another word, Machita turned and stormed from Jumana's office, slamming the door with a loud crack. Seconds later, Jumana's aide knocked and entered. "The Major seems upset." "A small difference of opinion," said Jumana without emotion. "A shame his motives are misdirected." He motioned outside. "Quickly, take two of my bodyguards and go to the communications wing. You should find Major Machita about to transmit a message to the general in Washington. Stop the transmission and arrest him." "Arrest the Major?" The aide was astonished. "On what charge?" Jumana thought a moment. "Passing secrets to the enemy. That should be sufficient to lock him in a basement cell until he can be tried and shot." Hiram Lusana stood in the entrance to the House of Representatives library and searched until he spied Frederick Daggett. The congressman was sitting at a long mahogany table, taking notes from a large leather-bound book. "I hope I'm not interrupting," said Lusana, "but your message sounded urgent, and your secretary said I might find you here." "Sit down," Daggett said, with no sign of friendliness. Lusana pulled up a chair and waited. "Have you read the late edition morning paper?" asked Daggett, again looking at the book. "No, I've been lobbying with Senator Moore of Ohio. He seemed most receptive to our cause after I explained the aims of the AAR. Apparently the senator missed the news, too." "What are you talking about?" Daggett reached into his breast pocket and handed a folded news clipping to Lusana. "Here, my friend, read it and weep. Insurgents massacre 165 villagers in raid. Tazarine, South Africa, UPI. At least 165 black inhabitants of the village of Tazarine in the province of Transvaal were killed in a seemingly senseless slaughter by African Army of Revolution insurgents in a dawn raid, South African defense officials report. An Army officer at the scene said the raid was carried out by an estimated 200 AAR guerrillas who swept into the village, shooting anything moving and chopping and hacking with bush knives. 46 women and children were murdered, some children still in their beds clutching dolls, one stunned investigator said, as he pointed to the burned remains of the once prosperous village. Militarily, it was a terrible waste, an act of pure animalistic savagery. One girl, about 4 years of age, was found with her throat slit. Pregnant women were found with large bruises on their abdomens, indicating they had been stomped to death. Defense Ministry officials were hard-pressed to speculate on what provoked the attack. All the victims were civilians. The nearest military installation is 12 miles away. Until now, the African Army of Revolution, led by American expatriate Hiram Jones, who now calls himself Hiram Lusana, has fought a strictly military war, attacking only South African defense forces and facilities. Barbaric assaults by other insurgent groups have been commonplace along South Africa's northern borders. Defense leaders find this new pattern most puzzling. The only previous type of massacre involving the AAR occurred during the Fox Farm raid in Umkhono-Natal, in which 32 were killed. It is known that Hiram Jones Lusana is currently in Washington soliciting support for the AAR. Lusana could not accept the article's impact until he had read it through 4 times. Finally, he looked up, shaken, and opened his palms in a gesture of amazement. "This is not my doing," he said. Daggett looked up from the book. "I believe you, Hiram. I am quite aware that gross stupidity is not one of your virtues. However, as commanding officer, you are responsible for the conduct of your troops." "Jumana," Lusana blurted as full realization dawned on him. "You're mistaken, Congressman. I am stupid. Tom Machita tried to warn me of Jumana's renegade leanings, but I refused to listen." "The heavyset colonel weighted down with medals," said Daggett. "I remember him from your cocktail party. A leader of a prominent tribe, I believe you said." Lusana nodded. "A favorite son of the Sorona tribe. He spent over 8 years in South African prisons before I arranged his escape. He has strong support throughout Transvaal province. Politically, I thought it an expedient move to name him my second in command. As with too many Africans who are suddenly thrust into a position of power, he apparently conjured up fantasies of grandeur." Lusana stood and leaned wearily against a shelf of books. "The idiot," he muttered almost to himself. "Can't he understand that he's destroying the very cause he's fighting for?" Daggett rose and put his hand on Lusana's shoulder. "I suggest you catch the first flight back to Mozambique, Hiram, and regain control of your movement. Issue news releases denying the AAR's involvement in the massacre. Blame it on the other insurgent groups if you have to. But get out from under and put your house in order. I'll do what I can to soften adverse reaction at this end." Lusana extended his hand. "Thank you, Congressman. I'm grateful for all you've done." Daggett shook his hand warmly. "And your subcommittee, how will they vote now?" Lusana said. Daggett smiled confidently. 3-2 in favor of aid to the AAR. Providing you offer a convincing performance in front of the news cameras when you deny any involvement with the Tazarine massacre." Colonel Joris Zegler had taken over the basement of a schoolhouse 10 miles from the boundary separating Natal Province and Mozambique. While class continued on the top 2 floors, Zegler and several ranking officers of the defense forces studied aerial maps and a scale mock-up of the AAR headquarters, not 25 miles away across the border. Zegler squinted through a wisp of smoke curling from the cigarette that dangled in his mouth and tapped a pointer on a miniature building in the center of the mock-up. "The former university administration building," he said, "is used by Lusana as his nerve center. A Chinese-supplied communications network, field staff offices, intelligence section, indoctrination rooms, they're all housed there. They've gone too bloody far this time. Destroy it and everyone in it, and you cut off the head of the AAR. "Begging your pardon, sir." This from a big red-faced captain with a bushy mustache. "But it was my understanding that Lusana was in America." "Quite correct. He's in Washington this very minute, on his hands and knees, begging the Yanks for financial support." "Then what bloody good is cutting off the serpent's head if the brain lies elsewhere? Why not wait until he returns and bag the head bugger as well?" Zeigler gave him a cold, condescending stare. "Your metaphor needs refining, Captain. However, to answer your question, it will not be practical to await Lusana's return. Our intelligence sources have confirmed that Colonel Randolph Jumana has engineered a mutiny within the ranks of the AAR. Surprised looks were exchanged among the officers clustered around the model. It was the first they'd heard of Lusana's ouster. "Now is the time to strike," he went on. "By brutally murdering helpless women and children at Tazarine, Jumana has thrown open the door for retaliation. An across-the-border raid on AAR headquarters has been approved by the Prime Minister. The usual diplomatic protests from third-world countries are to be expected, of course. A formality, nothing more. A tough-looking customer with the rank of major and dressed in camouflage fatigues raised his hand. Zeigler acknowledged him. "Your intelligence report also mentions the presence of Vietnamese advisors and possibly a few Chinese observers. Surely our government will suffer repercussions if we snuff the bastards." "Accidents happen," Zeigler said. "If a foreign national by chance stumbles into your line of fire, do not lose sleep if a stray bullet sends him straight away to Buddha Land. They have no business being in Africa. Defense Minister Duval is aware of the likelihood and has consented to let that particular problem rest on his shoulders." Zeigler turned his attention back to the mock-up. "Now, gentlemen, for the final phase of the attack. We have decided to take a page from the AAR handbook on the policing of a battlefield." He smiled without humor. "Except we intend to go them one better." Thomas Machita shivered in his cell. He couldn't remember when he had felt so cold. The temperature of the African interior had run its normal course, from 90 degrees the previous afternoon to a frosty 30 in the hours prior to dawn. Jumana's goons had dragged Machita from the radio room before he could send a message of warning to Lusana in Washington. They savagely pulverized his face before stripping away his clothes and throwing him in a damp little cell in the building's basement. One eye was swollen shut. A deep gash above the other eyebrow had coagulated during the night, and he had vision after wiping away the clotted blood. His lips were swollen and two teeth were missing, courtesy of a well-aimed rifle butt. He shifted his position on a filthy pile of dried leaves, gasping at the pain that stabbed his cracked ribs. Machita lay in dark frustration, gazing vacantly at the concrete walls of his prison as the new day's light filtered through a small barred window above his head. The cell was no more than a cube, 5 by 5 by 5 feet, and barely allowed enough room for Machita to lie down, provided he raised his knees. The low arched door to the basement hall was 3-inch-thick mahogany and had no latch or handle on the inside. He heard voices through the window and painfully pulled himself to a stooped position and looked out. The window faced the camp's parade ground at eye level. Elite commando sections were lining up for roll call and inspection. Across the way, mess hall roof vents emitted shimmering waves of heat as the cooks stoked their stoves to life. A company of recruits from Angola and Zimbabwe crawled sleepily from their tents at the prodding of their veteran section leaders. It began like another ordinary day of political indoctrination and combat training. But this day was to be far different. His eyes aimed intently at his watch, Joris Zeigler spoke softly into a field radio. "Tonic One?" "Tonic One in position, sir," a voice crackled over the receiver. "Tonic Two?" "Ready to fire, Colonel." 10 seconds and counting," said Zeigler. 5, 4, 3, 2. The formation of commandos on the parade ground dropped to the ground in concert as though by command. Machita could not believe that 200 men had died almost instantly as a salvo of gunfire erupted from the dense bush surrounding the perimeter of the camp. He jammed his face against the bars, unmindful of his pain, twisting his head to see better through his one functioning eye. The firing increased in intensity as confused AAR soldiers began a hopeless counterattack against their unseen enemy. He could distinguish the cracking sounds of the AAR's Chinese CK-88 automatic rifles from the Israeli-manufactured Philo guns used by the South African Defense Forces. The Philo gun emitted a barking noise as it shotgunned swarms of deadly razor-sharp discs capable of severing an 8-inch tree trunk with one burst. Machita realized the South Africans had crossed the border in a lightning raid to avenge Tazarine. "Damn you, Jumana!" he shouted in helpless rage. "You brought this upon us!" Bodies were dropping everywhere in frenzied contortions. So many littered the parade ground it was impossible to walk from one side to the other without stepping on torn flesh. A Defense Forces helicopter swooped over the main dormitory, where a company of men had taken cover. A bulky packet dropped from the aircraft's cargo door and landed on the roof. Seconds later, the building fragmented in a thunderous explosion of brick and dust. Still, the South African ground forces had not shown their positions. They were wiping out the main core of the AAR without the slightest risk to themselves. Brilliant planning and execution had paid the whites rich dividends. The green and brown of the helicopter's camouflage blurred into Machita's view for an instant, disappearing above the headquarters building housing his cell. He braced his pain-racked body against the inevitable explosion. The concussion was 2-3 times what he expected. The breath was pounded from his lungs as if by a jackhammer. Then the ceiling of his cell closed down on him and his tiny world went black. "They're coming in now, sir," said a sergeant, saluting smartly. Peter Duval acknowledged the message with a methodical wave of his swagger stick. "Then I think we should extend them the courtesy of greeting, don't you?" "Yes, sir." The sergeant opened the car door and stood aside as Duval unlimbered himself from the blackness of the back seat, meticulously straightening his tailored uniform, and began walking toward the grass landing pad. They both stood there for a minute and screwed up their eyes as the bright glare of the helicopter's landing lights cut the evening darkness. Then the gust from the approaching rotor blades forced them to clamp their hands to their caps and turn away as small pebbles blown from the pad pelted their backs. With perfect precision, the Defense Forces copters hovered in sequence until all 12 were aligned. Then, on order from the squadron commander, they eased gracefully to the ground as one unit, and the lights blinked out. Zeigler emerged from the lead craft and trotted over to Duval. "How did it go?" the defense minister asked. Zeigler's grin was barely visible in the darkness. "One for the history books, minister. An incredible exploit. There are no other words to describe it." "Casualties?" 4 wounded, none seriously." "And the rebels?" Zeigler paused for effect. "The body count tallied at 2,310. At least another 200 lie buried in the rubble of the destroyed buildings. No more than a handful could have escaped into the bush."
"Good God!"
Duval was shocked.
"Are you serious?"
"I checked the body count twice.
In our wildest expectations, we conceived no more than a few hundred rebel dead."
"A windfall," said Zeigler. "The camp was lined up for inspection. It was what the Americans would call a turkey shoot. Colonel Randolph Jumana was cut down by the first salvo."
"Jumana was an idiot," Duval snapped. "His days were numbered. Thomas Machita, there's the cagey one. Machita is the only bastard in the AAR who could fill Lusana's boots."
"We identified several officers on Lusana's staff, including Colonel Duc Phan Lo, his Vietnamese military advisor. But Machita's body did not turn up. I believe I'm safe in saying his remains are buried under tons of debris." Zeigler paused and stared Duval in the eyes. "In view of our success, Herr Minister, it might be wise to scratch Operation Wild Rose."
"Why not quit while we're ahead, is that it?"
Zeigler silently nodded.
"I am a pessimist, Colonel. It may take months, perhaps years, for the AAR to recover, but recover they will." Duval seemed to sink into a private reverie. Then he shook it off. So long as South Africa lives under the threat of black rule, we have no option but to use any method available to survive. Wild Rose will take place as planned. I'll feel better when Lusana falls in our net. Duval threw Zegler an off-kilter grin. You haven't heard? Sir? Irem Lusana won't be coming back to Africa, ever. Machita had no way of telling when he had recrossed the threshold of consciousness. He could see nothing but darkness. Then the pain began multiplying in his nerve endings, and he groaned involuntarily. His ears recorded the sound, but nothing else registered. He tried to raise his head, and a yellowish ball appeared above and to his left. Slowly, the strange object came into focus and formed a frame of reference. He was looking at a full moon. He struggled to a sitting position with his back crammed against a cold, bare wall. In the light that sifted through the wreckage, he could see that the floor above had dropped only 2 feet before becoming wedged between the narrow walls of his cell. After a brief rest to collect his strength, Machita began pushing away the rubble. His hands discovered a short length of board, and he used it to pry away the topside flooring until at last he forced an opening large enough to crawl through. Cautiously, he peered over the edge into the chilly night air. Nothing stirred. He bent his knees and shoved his body upward until his hands touched the grass of the parade ground. A sudden heave, and he was free. Machita took a deep breath and looked around. It was then that he saw the miracle of his salvation. The wall of the administration building facing the parade field had caved inward, collapsing the first floor, which had effectively shielded his cell from falling debris and the deadly wrath of the South Africans. No one greeted Machita as he staggered to his feet, because there was no one in sight. The moon illuminated an eerie, barren landscape. Every facility, every building, had been leveled. The field was empty. The bodies of the dead were gone. It was as though the African Army of Revolution had never existed.